Video overview, introduction of the topic, overview of Solidarity Collectives, and interview with Anton from Solidarity Collectives. Solidarity Collectives is a group of Ukrainian anarchists who united when the Russian invasion began of Ukraine. Three main areas of work include military, humanitarian, and media. There's roughly 100 anti-authoritarian members in the Ukrainian military receiving assistance from Solidarity Collectives. And the collective network includes various organizations and groups from Ukraine, Germany, Poland, France, the United States, Netherlands, Canada, and many other countries. A quote from their website describing what the group is all about. Based on our anti-authoritarian values, we decided to actively resist Russian aggression. We support the right of the Ukrainian people to self-defense and consider the Russian invasion an imperialist act. This topic was discussed in many previous videos, but specifically Ukraine Anarchism and Solidarity with Tom from Rhizome House. In this, we talk about International Fighting Forces and Cooper Andrews specifically. So the collective does aid with anti-authoritarian fighters that are involved with the Ukrainian military, but they engage in other things as well. And so these are just some clips from their socials. On the top, we see medical aid for fighters in Ukraine. And in the lower left, there's some more specific technical equipment that was given, clothes and shoes, and various military needs. However, we also see that a car was given. This is very necessary on the front lines for numerous reasons. But it's not just relegated to military support of comrades who are engaging in this battle to fight Russian imperialism. For instance, in the center, we also see something about a trip that was taken over the summer with partners in various trade unions throughout Europe. On the bottom, we see humanitarian aid, in which the group is dropping off laptops for educational purposes for Ukrainian students. And in the lower right, we see a vegan food setup. Benefits from the selling of this vegan cookbook will go to Ukrainian anti-authoritarian fighters. So there's many different things ranging from vegan cookbooks to laptops to Ukrainian students to cars for people on the front lines that the group is engaged in. And so that's a very rough, high-level introduction of the group. Let's jump over to their website to look at their manifesto, their blog, and some other specifics before we get to the interview. Okay, so here is the website for Solidarity Collectives. On the front, in the English version of the site, support anti-authoritarian fighters in Ukraine. Let's look at the About Us really quickly, even though we've already gone over like a high level. I think the first paragraph and the fourth paragraph are interesting for us to understand what the group is all about. We are Solidarity Collectives, a group of Ukrainian anarchists who united when the Russian invasion began in order to support our comrades fighting at the front and to help those affected by the Russian invasion. And so they go on to talk about some specifics about what it is that they help with. I think that this is important too. In the fourth paragraph, it states, "Our struggle is a struggle against colonial imperial politics, according to which the world order is determined by whoever has more weapons and fossil deposits. We are fighting against false propaganda and hypocritical geopolitical compromises. We are fighting for a world order in which people choose their own path in development and do not submit to the powers of dictators." So this tells you something about their view on the Russian invasion. Of course, already stated that this is viewed as an imperialist invasion. So scrolling back up to the top, I'm going to jump over to the manifesto. Now, I'm not going to read the whole manifesto because it's a few paragraphs long, but I would urge you, if you're all interested in knowing more about the group, to go to the website and check it out. I think this paragraph is pretty important. Based on our anti-authoritarian values, we decided to actively resist Russian aggression. We support the right of the Ukrainian people to self-defense and consider the Russian invasion an imperialist act. Despite the multidimensionality of a global event, the key reasons for this war are the imperial policy of the Russian Federation, the belief in the historical mission of the Russian elites, and an attempt to establish control over what they think is their sphere of influence. The reason should not be sought neither in the economic interest of the Russian oligarchy nor in Russian security precautions, and especially not in NATO scheming. Full support of the Ukrainian people in their struggle, which doesn't necessarily mean supporting the government's policies, is the only consistent stance for anarchists and leftists worldwide. Continuing, Ukrainians wage an armed struggle against Russia because there is no other way of effective resistance now. Classic pacifist recipes don't work here because the sides of the conflict aren't equal. If the Russian army surrenders, the war will end. If Ukrainian soldiers lay down their weapons or turn them against their government, as some experts on Ukraine suggest, the Russian army will occupy more territories and commit more war crimes. Both solutions are equally unrealistic, though, and reality requires practical answers and specific actions. So I think that that's really great because it tackles two things. One, it tackles the idea of imperialism, and two, it tackles the concept of pacifism. And those are two topics that are discussed broadly on social media in good faith and bad faith in the West. Lastly, I'm going to move to the blog. They do have a needs section, and you can look at it. However, the suggestion is always to contact them directly on their many social media platforms, which I'll link in the description to this, to ask for specifics about what's going on currently. So here on the blog, we have people who have died. So comrades or friends, people that were connected somehow with the many groups that formed Solidarity Collectives after the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine. And so here we have a journalist, but what I wanted to go down to was Cooper Andrews, aka Harris. And this is who I was discussing before. There's an episode that doesn't talk about him, but that discusses him in depth because of his connections to the Rhizome House in Ohio. And Tom from the Rhizome House was nice enough to meet with me and talk not only about Cooper, but about what they're doing there and some broader geopolitical international topics. So Solidarity Collectives is a group or a network of anti-authoritarians who were involved in different focuses prior to the war, ranging from anarchism to feminism. The collective connects internationally for support of their efforts to aid comrades fighting against Russian aggression. This includes support of the military, of course, but also humanitarian initiatives and media projects. Next, you'll hear a discussion with Anton, who works with Solidarity Collectives. And as a little note, excuse any audio hiccups. There is a great distance between us as Anton is currently in Ukraine and I'm in the United States. All right, I have Anton with Solidarity Collectives here. And to get the conversation started, I'm going to let Anton introduce himself and tell us a little bit about what Solidarity Collectives does, when it formed, and its background.
Yeah, hi. So I work as what we call a coordinator for the military side of our collective, mainly, and I also deal with some media or talks generally. But like Solidarity Collectives started now about a year and a half ago, like at the beginning of the full scale invasion from Russia in Ukraine. And out of the need and the decision of some comrades who decided to fight against the Russian army. So what we do is the support logistic on the and all that is accessible from civilians to help them in this fight. So there was a decision late February, let's say 2022, of some that knew that would fight. We had also some comrades who were active in these fights since some years, but mostly it was not how to say, like a very collective decision of everybody having the same ideas about it. You had some who didn't want to be involved with the army, and some who were more clear about it. Some people for several years were also training for in case of invasion, but more as something that would resemble like partisan fighting, like not like being part of a regular army and the kind of war that we are now in, which is like mostly artilleristic and attrition, and it's very different than what people were actually training for since the last years. But what we have been doing now for a year and a half has been like building a network also with like different groups that you can find in Europe or in USA, or individuals also that wanted to support, because there was a call on international level at the beginning of the invasion from our side. That was actually answered quite well. Like we received a lot of solidarity for what we've been doing. Since last summer, generally, we also started like something that would be out of civilian relief, because some groups or unions from Europe mostly wanted also like to try to help unions here and also like civilians from who can be in cities or villages who are closer to front lines and still under shellings on everyday base. So we decided to have a separate, also like we call it department, but for humanitarian, like civilian mutual aid relief somehow. And this is still existing. Like we have been going to Liman or Nikopol or near Kherson, like or to help rebuild houses, or to distribute some laptops, for example, for school children in Liman, for to be more safe to continue studying. This kind of things. What I can say about the work today is that we continue supporting, let's say, around 100 like comrades who are fighting. All of them, like how we decided to support, is like people that we knew from activist life from the past. From Ukraine, you have some internationals, meaning from Belarus, from Russia, and some from Western world. And it's, I mean, we've lost now in the year and a half quite many comrades already that got killed here. Some also like not Ukrainians, some Ukrainians we can, and one person that maybe in USA you've heard of was Cooper Andrews,
yeah,
that got killed in the end of April this year, together with two other comrades that were also internationals. So yeah, I mean the ones who we continue to support, like it's a very wide type of activists, but mainly we call it from the anti-authoritarian movement, which has its history for more than 100 years. Like it was a way to define, or like anarchists and mixed with maybe some Marxists that didn't agree with the logic that we should take the state and put the proletarian dictator on this kind of stuff, but mainly like anarchists and some limited Marxists who didn't want to be part of the state, let's say. And nowadays it's still like this, like it's a mix of feminists, you have anti-fascists, football hooligans, you have anarchists from different kind of organizing, is it like for ecology or social struggles, like unionists from student unions that have been existed for several years. So yeah, very, very different people that didn't have before like something like a common, I mean, there was talks, there was discussions about what to do, but since the full-scale invasion, like, the practice became very common, meaning the fight against the, we wouldn't call like fascist, like the term that is used is like racist somehow, and because it's to define it with a different term, so it's not like Italian fascism, it's not Nazism, it's a different kind, but still with this very authoritarian structure for, well, the time that it has lasted is very long, but still, this was like the decision was to fight in this. So there is now like a collective practice where we find each other. And in solidarity collectives, it's also different people that find, I mean, from different kind of activism, but that knew or learned to know each other since a year and a half. And we continue like this with this agreement that this is the priority today for organizing.
Yeah, that kind of probably answers my next question, but I'll ask anyway. And that's, you know, sometimes in organizing with anarchist groups, anti-fascist groups, you know, a loose network, you know, of different people that have some things in common, others not. It can be a little bit difficult. It can be a little loose, you know, people come and go. But it sounds like the reality of what's happening made disagreements that I think people might see rhetorically or in conversation or, you know, online, much more clear, because what needed to be done became more clear. I think that's, you know, maybe something important for people in the West to understand as well, about, you know, the reality of what was happening with Russian aggression kind of, you know, made that praxis very clear for what needed to happen, right?
Yeah, I mean, for me, this is a playable bit everywhere. Like, I mean, the need to change the conditions where you live is what makes you organize together. Yeah. And then you have the cultural that comes with it, that there it can be more or less clear, the relations between people. But for several years, I mean, the people who were organizing knew each other, and that's how it was possible for us here to create what is being done today. But the need for the people in this situation, depending where they were, like, were they in the East, where were they in Kyiv last year, a year and a half ago, it created very different needs to be in communication with others, and then and for sure it has like brought everybody together on this common practice. But I wouldn't say it's really a surprise. It's more that there was this subcultural what could be concepts and this, and then more of course people than what are the activists. But on the activist level, everybody kind of knew each other's from anyway, from the actions from before, or found each other's before, because maybe for some years we're making a pause or we're somewhere else or something like this. But yes, of course, like this kind of happening, what like with the full scale invasion, have made it very clear that there is a need to find each other's and to be active, because there was really a need. Like, it's as clear as this.
Right. And so when that did happen, I think we kind of described it maybe as like there being different, you know, like phases of the group or the operation. And you kind of talked about it already, but I think it's probably, I think it's interesting for people to hear, because, you know, when we talk about organizing, and I'll kind of ask this later, it's not done within the realm of a conflict zone, even if where you're physically at might not be, you know, in that. It's still the broader environment and of what's happening. So with the three phases of your operation, you have you have assistance from military, right? Comrades that you know that are in the military or not, And then you kind of have this like humanitarian angle. You discussed, for instance, distributing tablets to school children. And, you know, that could be they're forced into distance learning because they're in regions that are unsafe or, you know, what have you, utilities and of course, COVID before that, too. And then there's like a media angle to this, too. So there's, you know, like three sections, I guess, of what this collective is doing, right?
Yeah, that's basically where we have found, because like, it's not like there was since the beginning a very clear way of how this would be organized, but from the practice we could see that those are like the three main like work categories that we have, and I also use work in the sense that of course now like the comrades who are fighting, like nearly everybody have a contract who can have also because on the long term. It's also regarding paycheck, just your everyday life in the back. Can you keep to rent an apartment? This kind of stuff. And what for this that we do for these three categories of work, it's also, I guess, because what we call media is not forcefully like a journalist or this, but it's also like discussions with different groups to seek support, also economical, but also because we need to keep in touch, and also to see who could also come to visit, because there was this kind of clear idea that came pretty fast after the beginning of the invasion, but at the beginning it was very hard to think about anything, but it became very clear that there is this questions about militarism, anti-militarism, that were at the level of like several years ago here, because here, let's say it started in 2014.
Yeah.
So there was already a conflict, and it was already more, let's say, in the consciousness of us here than what is happening outside where you are not in conflict. So the questions were very different, but there was already a knowledge of how to talk about it, because there is an experience for now many years already about what it is to try to think in this. Then so in the media, this was the main at the beginning, and then became because of more getting more attention on the, also on international level on our collective. So then there is also like that tried to speak with bigger medias also, like this has happened and brought its own challenges also for us. But clearly, at the beginning, was really the military work was the main, was the where there was the most need, and it also started with a mix of what you could call different networks, like also from Europe, like some people who started directly to organize to help, like for example from Poland. You had some groups who were more connected also with comrades here. So this was, for some things, it was also like finding each other's. Like there was this kind of structure, like let's say on the media, Operation Solidarity, so knowing with who to try to connect. This brought to some problems end of June, and then we ended Operation Solidarity to become Solidarity Collectives. But in this time, there was found who from different groups closer also in Europe would stay in connection, who from Ukrainian side it was possible to work with, and who was getting completely or tired or having clearly like their own corruption schemes or this. This was taken off also of the collective. And since then we worked with this name. And until now we continue quite well and learn to know each other better. On the humanitarian side, me personally, I don't like the name, and I don't think any of us really like it, because it doesn't really resemble what we do, but those are by default that we use, because they are still the most widespread use in the words to what's happening. But it's mostly also like out of connections from before with union organizers And this is how was launched a lot of the community of the who we started to help, and in which cities and in which villages, or by connection from activists who are in solidarity collectives in different regions directly with some people who could be in touch with their municipality. And this, for example, for the rebuilding of houses, with the decision that we cannot be like, maybe it will come, but I mean, there was not the numbers to be active as sending people on in every places, but try to organize with local. So this was more like the logic, because we can have a touch with groups in the West also to come to help and to be in communication. So mostly we wanted to build this like bridges, so that groups and people who feel that they are in the same political, I don't know, environment, or trying to push same kind of ideas, at least to be in touch and support each other, because we cannot and we don't want, like, it became very obvious, for example, in Kherson after the floods,
yeah,
that there was a lot of will, and it's very beautiful to see that people want to go and help. But what became very obvious after a few days was that the locals organized fully. You had people from other cities like helping, because they just know each other's, and so it was how to help these networks that just do like self-organized networks of people in the region, and to push it to exist, and then to show that it exists to people who don't know about it and who might want to help, let's say from the West Europe, which is still seen as the place where there is a will to connect at the moment, because the connections with Russia now are completely destroyed, and then there's nothing to seek really from there as help. So yeah,
and you talked about a few interesting things, but I think one is, you know, the connections to people. And that was something I wanted to ask you about too, but with a lot of qualifiers, in that I think for some people in the West, what they know is what they see in traditional media, you know, and those can be like caricatures or generalizations, you know. So I think that there might be an idea of what a Ukrainian soldier is, for instance, and it can be not necessarily a good one sometimes, you know. Earlier, just now, you talked about some of the your comrades that you know knew or were part of organizing, but without, you know, making generalizations, maybe anecdotally, are there just types of people that you've encountered in organizing, whether it's with the military or in the humanitarian section? You know, not all these people are far right kind of figures, and that's how it's often portrayed in the West.
Yeah, of course, the narrative that the Ukraine right would be full of Nazis and right wing people, and this came directly also as a so called justification from Russia to just attack and destroy and kill everybody, and it's still the case. So of course this was pretty widespread, and I'm not sure which kind of media, because I think there has been a lot of work to try to counter this propaganda. And but still it exists,
yeah.
And because sure since 2014 it was pretty obvious that there was groups also like from far right who started to organize to be able to fight after the Maidan events, all this history, but it's like a very small amount of people if you count what is Ukrainians. It's like very, very small compared to the general, like it's still a country of 45 million people, and we if you count all the brigades, you can find all on internet really about numbers, and you will see that like on percentages it's very small, and also politically it never existed, like it was less than 2% on the parliament ever since 2014.
Yeah.
Which is like largely less than what you can see in many countries, for example, in Europe. But in the military also, since the beginning of, of this full-scale invasion, there was 300,000 people in the Ukrainian army, and now at the end of the summer 2022, it was about 1 million people that were like revendicated, let's say, or trying to sign contracts and this, and it's still somehow at this level. So it means you have more than three times more people who are now in the military. So all those people were civilians a year and a half ago. So it's really Ukrainians defending themselves that were not in any like really related with withholding again or fighting from before, so have been learning all this, and so this is also the reason why there is so much volunteer work, which is kind of what we say we do. We just do it on an organized level, but it's something seen a lot in Ukraine, that people help their friends, their family member, someone they know that is now fighting. So it's a popular army in this sense. And the state didn't have the means or the logistics to bring to everybody like the protective gears and this. So this is how our work started, also because of the need for it. And now we already see the results of it, meaning we have been receiving plates that have been shot and have saved some comrades that we could deliver, like for example a year ago. So we see the effect of this, of what it means on the battlefield, if you have or not the gear to protect you, and will you survive longer or not. Like this is very clear. Yeah. As for the participation now in the army, sure, I guess for some, because it's heard as a question pretty often, I guess also because of what is the ideas of what is anarchy, what is anti-authoritarianism in general, but generally they are thought by groups who are in countries in peace or protected by NATO, quite frankly, and who question out of really what you could call like blue eye, without really having thought of what is war, what is anti-authoritarianism in war. You have, for example, like this Spanish anarchists who were liberating Paris in the Allied in the Second World War, for example. This is one story of a very big bunch of anarchists who they thought that it would be France, Germany, and then that they would get the help from the Allies to get to Franco. This didn't happen, but still. Nowadays, comparable situation would be with Belarusian comrades here who fight here, but have decided that maybe after it could lead to some more liberation also in Belarus, or Russian comrades here who are fighting. All this, what I mean is that the practice of it is not something new in the anti-authoritarian movement or anarchist movement. In Ukraine, you had also people like Nikiforova, who went to train, for example, in the French army to become a commander and to know how to use those skills.
There's a whole history. I mean, you're talking about Spanish Civil War, of course, yeah. But even, just looking at your website, I don't see many people talking about anarchists in Ukraine or trade unionists in Ukraine or feminists in Ukraine, environmental or ecologists in Ukraine, and what they're doing and how they're organizing and how, even within their avenues or their what they're emphasizing, how, that comes back, of course, to this invasion from Russia. I don't know. I think that it would be, interesting for people to know that, these people exist, and many of them are, working with groups like yours in Ukraine.
Yeah, I guess for ecological radical activists, you have the Eco Platform, for example. They are completely reachable also through Telegram. I mean, for most of the groups that were previous, still some would still use also like their social medias. So I guess it could be possible, but most who don't have a part of their collectives who remain civilians, the use of social media can be very less easy when you are on a soldier's life. But I mean, you can also join. I mean, talk on the internet with the resistance committee. You can also find on Telegram, and if you want to send a message to check what's going on, it's highly possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's easy to be in touch with us. Sure, we try to be more visible. I don't think, I mean, something that is a bit specific to post-Soviet countries is also that we are a bit strange in the sense that we openly say about anti-authoritarianism, leftism, anarchism, that are things that under USSR, I mean, they could be related with USSR in general, so it's not very famous, let's say, for people to know about it, because there was not really big movement, because it was not it could be very easily connected with this. But mainly people would use open-minded for progressive people in Ukraine, which is like the most commonly used. So in this sense we are a bit strange, but not sure for this. I mean, it's not like something huge if you count the activists, but I don't think it's something huge actually in many places. But then there was, of course, a lot more people participating for demonstrations, for feminist demonstrations, for queer struggles that are not connected forcefully as like in the same collective, but are still active. And yeah, it's also, for example, on the humanitarian side, there's a lot of connections with different feminist groups. Like you have Fem Solution, you could have Bilkis. So queer or feminist organizations who are also active, like or in Lviv or in Kyiv, and who had a practice of trying to help women specifically in the East with some things. So I mean, we kept in touch with other groups that still exist, and also because people who are in solidarity collectives could be from those groups from before. So now there is like a more vivid culture to get back also to other political struggles, so as also groups, because for one period, let's say the first month, it was really just this military is the most important, this is where there is, but now the political life started again as well. So I mean, it's more like a network, these solidarity collectives of people from who are from different groups. Not everybody has their own group practices also at the moment, because maybe the rest of the group is not available but yeah, it still works like this.
Yeah, and I guess it goes back to that, to the organizing, and there was no blueprint, you know, set out for how to do this. There are historical examples, you know, of course, but I think the realities of organizing in a conflict zone or for a conflict zone, it's an interesting topic. And did you receive any assistance? I believe maybe that you had received some ideas, maybe from like Kurdish liberation organizers or trade unionists in Europe. Were there like specific entities that you all kind of leaned on or collaborated with to outline what it is that you could do, or was it much more spontaneous and these other things kind of just seeped in?
One thing that was pretty obvious is that let's say in the West, was the connection with groups that were already working on the solidarity with what's happening in Kurdistan. For Rojava, for example, that already had a practice on being in solidarity with a group of people, but also specific activists, and this like in a place where it's it's war, people get killed, and it's very specific.
Yeah.
Way of organizing. On a practical level, for here, many things we had to learn, really, just together with the groups also, like from the West, who were trying to help. Also because at the beginning, nothing we could get from Ukraine, everything you could get from outside. So everything was brought, and then this changed. So also the organizing changed, because mainly after the summer, it was clear that what we need is money, because we can buy everything, we can get everything. At the beginning, it was a lot of things, because you just couldn't get most of the things in Ukraine. We try to get more advices. It's mostly related to how to have like this solidarity work ongoing with different networks, and where to make events and this. On the practical level, on how to organize, on what means the fighting, what means the what we're doing with the logistics. We've been finding it just by practice, let's say, and because we are not in a situation where what we do is being blocked by state rules or being blocked by, we are not under occupation, for example, or something like this. So, I mean, we could find that our practices are also common in the society, and there is no will from the state to block them. So we haven't had to learn some things that we couldn't talk with other people in the society. So I mean, it's pretty easy to find also help to organize it, and then we just do it on a more organized level than some other people doing volunteering. But there is also other volunteer organizations. So we have a good network also from here of how to learn, also from just people who knew others from before the invasion, and who are doing different organizations. Then on the political level of what it means, it's been also very interesting to talk with some limited from Kurdish liberation movement on what it means as what you do as your politics, how that changed in time of war, how you try to deal with them in this moment of like emergency at the same time. And on this, I guess it was more about the very easily to have an understanding of why things are done in a certain way. Mm-hmm. This was like the most like on a relief of finding some people with who you can very easily understand each other, even if they don't live in the same place than you, but just understanding the conditions. On this, that's, we must remain active, and so we learn also, and we try to write the theory that is useful for us by being active. Like, this is the first point in what we do. So yeah, in this sense, yes.
Yeah, and that kind of that goes to another point. You know, but it's tied to this idea of solidarity, organizing, mutual aid, maybe, you know, within the context of conflict, whether, yeah, we're talking about, you know, Kurdish people or Ukrainian people. And that's the opposite, I guess, the question that you hear. And it's always difficult, you know, whether or not you take it as the people are being authentic or they have, you know, ulterior motives. But the idea of maybe, you know, peace activists or anti-militarists in the West calling for negotiations or peace, you know, and I think we talked a little bit before about, you know, what it would mean in very clear terms if Russia occupied more of Ukraine or won this battle and, you know, took over Ukraine, what that would mean to, well, people like you. You know, for instance. So I'll kind of leave that up to you, if we want to talk about, you know, what would you say to somebody in the United States or England or France or something saying, you know, we need peace. We need to stop this and talk to Russia, maybe without a clear understanding of what those repercussions would be in very clear terms.
Yeah. Well, for me, this brings to many different possible understanding of like what is this asks for peace, but at least for what is like people, for what would be called like anti-authoritarian movement, one very basic thing would be that you should be in touch with the people who are concerned and first listen, and then from this try to organize your thought and like to be able to change it, because otherwise you arrive with a position of knowledge, and like, I mean, this wouldn't fit in my idea of, I don't know, generally with these political ideas. And so sometimes we've been hearing people talking about anti-militarism on a position base from outside Ukraine. Some are very also aggressive with it, but the thing is that anti-militarism, I mean, militarism in general is something that is about being part of an army to attack another place, if you look at the definition. And of course, this is not what we are doing here. This is not what's happening. This is a society defending itself against a full-scale invasion, destruction, and killing going on. So like the possibility to defend yourself, I don't think anybody actually would question this. And this is what's happening. So it's not about militarist or not militarist, like this is not the question of what's happening. So for some people, I'm not sure about groups, but for some it would be a doubt. Is it really an intention to just be on some kind of always opposing or having an idea that you cannot change, and you think that because you are a few people and you decided something, like the whole world should follow your idea or something like this, which would be something that just, okay, that there's just nothing to get out of this. Or some people who are really just caught also on Russian propaganda that is calling for this kind of peace. And there also it's a bit strange, like, I mean, you have some groups, for example, from one from UK, I mean, there are some, like, generally, I think I could cite you even who was writing this kind of thing, but it's like, because it's very few, but they've been writing a lot, but it's like you can see connections with or trying to organize in the time of COVID, like on some kind of anti, like saying like you should participate in the anti-COVID struggles in Europe. And then with you can see some kind of path from this to continue in Russian propaganda. So is it like that they found wrong Telegram channel, as you could say also here, like for some grandparents, that sometimes you would hear very strange things and you're like, what have you found on the internet again? Because the just those propaganda tools are a bit everywhere and they're trying to aim at different or political schemes or just people. So they try to get on the left, they try to get on the right, to anarchists everywhere with this Russian propaganda, like, but just even with bots. So when you start to hear these kind of things that are like repetitive themes that you don't hear from anybody in Ukraine. So obviously they don't come from here, those ideas. They come from somewhere else. So I guess should be asked why those people are listening to other ideas, that mostly those ideas are pushed from Russia. So I would just say this about this this one topic about peace and these kind of things. For what it is for us here in Ukraine, are you from here or like Belarus or Russia or even from anywhere now, like fighting or participating in it? Very obviously, even today, because we still don't know what will be the outcome of this fight. There is many different possibilities, but if, for example, would be followed this idea that you shouldn't use again just let the occupation and I'm just saying one example, like, and then struggle inside somehow occupied Ukraine by Russia with other Russian workers and something like this been heard. Very practically, this would mean that you have now about 1 million people fighting, not counting only our comrades who slowly would get killed. Then, if it's occupied, everybody that has been organized publicly would be directly chased by the Russian services and most likely killed. This would be the first month. You would see just a massacre here. And then occupation, surveillance everywhere in the same style than what you see in Russia or what you see in Belarus, in some ways even in the worse. Minimum, no political organizing other than the states and the control going on. And if you try to do something, you will be tortured, you will go to prison, or you will be killed. This would be the only future for all of us. And since also this, like, none of those things, you will not hear anybody in Ukraine at the moment saying you that this makes any sense. And so, yeah, I would just say this about this subject here.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the exacerbation at kind of on its face, you know, how ridiculous it is. But, you know, there's also some... go ahead.
It's dangerous for us because, I mean, I could say that, you know, on a feeling level, how it feels is like having a gun pointed at you and then having on the back the wall on which one you will be shot. It feels like this to have on your back from the West, hearing Russian propaganda and hearing that you should do something else than what you do. Yeah. And in this situation, this you should do something else means you should get killed. Yeah. Very, very straightforwardly said is this. So yeah, it is dangerous more than ridiculous for how I hear it.
That's even better. Yeah. No, thanks for saying that. Because, yeah, that's why I asked the question, because people need to hear that. Right. And it's, you know, there's that, which is the primary, you know, the number one, the fact it's not ridiculous, it's life and death. But there's also, this might be point six or seven down the list lower. There's also something to it that I can observe from a Western point of view that's very, you know, even regardless of how people describe themselves, you know, they say, I'm this, I'm that. There's something about it that's very neocolonial. It's very imperialist, you know, to me. It's one superpower listening to another superpower and telling the people in the middle who are being attacked what they need to do in order to cease that from happening. And, you know, I think that there are people, you know, there are military people, right-wing people, people interested in geopolitics that are fine with that, you know, Harry Kissinger and people like that. But it's interesting, disappointing, you know, when you hear people say things like, I'm a leftist, I'm a pacifist, I'm a socialist, I'm this and that. And you know, this war, we need to stop this war. This is NATO, blah, blah, blah. I don't know that, you know, stepping back and seeing, well, the repercussions of what you're saying means a lot of death, number one. You know, and if you're worried about that from war, you're going to cause equal amounts in a different way anyway. But then also just how imperialistic and Western-centric, you know, it is, that kind of West-splaining of what you need to do in order for you to, I guess, have the right to survive. I don't know. Have you encountered that or spoken about that with your comrades at all?
Well, yeah, I mean, of course, war is something scary. So that some people would like to see the end of it and to call for it.
Right.
You cannot say it sounds bad. In this sense, like, of course, here also everybody in this sense is a pacifist,
right?
because the aim of it is to stop the war, but there is just no other way than by fighting. This is the only point in it. But of course, in a sense, like everybody in Ukraine would like this to stop, would like their friends, their relatives to stop being killed, their cities stopping being bombed. I mean, of course, this we talk about it in this sense between us, and we try to share this. But for what you mentioned about the colonialism, the imperialism from Russia, I mean, one here I think we have a good example, just like from what we said before, like for example, the fact that for some, like Ukrainians don't exist. It's they are between two big powers. Ukrainians don't exist, and this is a sign of, you know, erasing people, in the sense that they can get killed. They don't really matter. And in this sense, there is like a dehumanization of what Ukrainians are, and this we can feel from many different sides. And of course, it's not only in Ukraine, but all the countries who have been between, let's say, Western Europe and Russia, for now several hundreds of years, have been the places of war between different imperialisms. So this history is very well known to Ukrainians, of what it means. Also for trying to know your history, understanding what your grandparents or others were trying to do in those situations, and how exactly fucked up many of the situations were to try to make any kind of decisions who would lead to you just survive in the situation where you are. And on this, I mean, for example, Crimea, huge displacement of people, and then exchange of population. This is very common history of what's going on in Ukraine, but also in other countries inside or outside what was Russian imperialism or USSR. The politics continued, and so all this, like the erasement of your understanding of your own history, the propaganda that was made also from Russia, also inside USSR, and how these histories were not written or written differently, or those histories, Holodomor didn't exist. It was not a pollution, it was some kind of something else. And when you talk in your families, you know what happened. Like it's easy. It's, but those kind of things are not in history books until 91. And then historians have to remake all the work to find it. So on all this, like how at the beginning of the invasion, and also still now, like how the Ukrainian language is not supposed to really exist. It's just like little Russia. Like this kind of things, like, should be very obvious to point at what is like the colonialism and the imperialism going on. Then on general analysis, there was one thing that I read that was interesting, because we for example also had the question, like, yeah, but we cannot call it colonialism because there was no seas that were crossed for Russia, for example. This is one thing that is sometimes brought up, which is, it's based on some study that has been made about what is the post-colonial, anti-colonial struggles. So it's also a list that needs to be done, I guess, from Ukraine and inside Russia, also like the anti-colonial movement, like that needs to be more strict on writing things, but it's, I guess. But or also this topic that, you know, like the second world was supposed to be the socialist world, and then you had the third world, but since the socialist world crumbled, there is not, what would be the position of the third world in this? So like it's just questioning the base of some of the theories of what is the anti-colonial studies. So it's not questioning, it's just, it's bringing another color to it that is being brought, I guess, internationally now, and is having the attention Maybe a bit late, or maybe just when it can, because now it's in a very specific conditions. But we can try now, like to speak about it. But it's something. I mean, for Ukrainians to speak about the imperialism of Russia is something so common. You just hear it everywhere. So it's very surprising when you get the question like, but how can you say this? Like, but okay, like there is for sure like a centrism in the West in the sense of being able to follow, how to say, the studies from the place where you live, but not from everywhere in the world. But this, I would guess, is also for everywhere. It's not only in the West. It's like to be able to understand what's going on worldwide. Means to actually study, look in history, understand, speak with people in different places. I mean, it means a lot of time that is not forcefully the most, the thing you have the most, let's say, when you have to work a lot for your life. So it's also understandable in this sense. So it's very, for me, it just depends if it's like this kind of, okay, I don't know. I know the things from where I am, and it can be interesting to discuss, or is it an intention to actually be part of the erasement of other people, which is actually saying it doesn't exist, which would be a very different question than that.
I think that there are people in the West, especially on the left, who are more open-minded to entities that the U.S. government calls the enemy, because they're so used to criticizing the U.S. government, and you know, sometimes that's what you should be doing, and that's true. You know, the United States, like many governments, creates propaganda and, you know, demonizes people to manufacture consent for war. You know, maybe in the modern sense, like in Iraq, for instance. You know, but I do think that people without that critical thinking or open-mindedness to objective history kind of find themselves being open-minded to what is just Russian propaganda to justify their own war in Ukraine. And there's a lot of irony, I think, in that, right? But even on your website, you stated, our struggle is a struggle against colonial imperial politics. And you know, where I just had left off was, I see that direct line, but I don't think a lot of people in the U.S. left and specific groups see it that way, and some even are so used to criticizing the United States government that, you know, it turns into this campist argument of the enemy of the United States is actually the good guy, and the U.S. is always the colonial imperial power because they're the global, you know, hegemon. So I don't know what thoughts are there on that, because I can imagine that's frustrating to hear.
Well, in a sense, me, I can link it to what would have been here, for example, what has been like, because some, let's say in the USSR, there was a big network of communist parties everywhere. In the West, and until USA, I don't know exactly how it was there, but in Europe, that has been also shaping a lot of what is the left today, into believing that that Russia was the representative of some kind of bright future until very late, and for some, you have the doubt that they even still live in this period, clearly, even today. Which then I don't know if it's like education, age, like for some people it's like pretty obvious that they just can't change their ideas anymore or something like this, and they just follow the same line. Then for what is like a critiquing the place where you live and being in opposition, and like I would guess for some it's like also like electoralists strategies to say something that might get you some votes or something like this, like very just practical things like this. So it's again it really depends what is the intention there, what those people do also practically, because very obviously in situations of politics, there can be a very big difference between what people do and what they say that should be done. So this should be also analyzed. So for me, it's more of a practical analysis of what it means for what is left, or I don't know, authoritarian left or less, or other groups saying things and what they actually do and why they say. Is it like work ongoing, or is it really like a position to try to block something that actually is dangerous for here? As for what is the understanding of, like, from USA, I guess it's the same than what is happening for also people in Russia, that, you know, when you are in places that are on the oppressed side, you actually understand what's going on in USA, you understand what's going on in Russia, because it's dangerous for you. So you understand what are the politics there, and you try to seek attention. Well, you don't need this if you are in USA or if you are in Russia, because you are already in the center of power, and your goal is to attain this power to then be able to shift the world, to shape the world, which is in itself colonial also. So all this will, I mean, it is to be analyzed and heard for sure in USA, and as well as in Russia for the anti, like the opposition in Russia, for a lot of it is opposition, but for a different war, or you would hear like very things that are not related to what's happening to Ukrainians or to what's happening clearly on like the but more on let's change it a bit, or maybe if we do, I mean, also of the tactics that would be used, like sometimes that are completely unrelated to the reality of the situation. And this goes also for in USA. It's also about what is actually the practices that are called by any kind of political speech. And this should be addressed in USA. And I guess the addressing the colonialism also from USA is also done inside USA, and I don't think it's so easy in the left to hear it in USA neither, inside, I mean, the movement. So I don't think it's typical to what's happening here. Here we are just further, but if I understood, it's not forcefully so easy also inside USA to understand the decolonial politics inside. So.
Yeah,
those are very big works, and how it will happen, I don't know exactly. We try to share about it from our side, that there is this understanding of what was on the USSR propaganda that we can see continue, and how this continues to kill today. So on this way we can talk about the continuity, and for this kind of, let's say, hope that what is happening now with Ukrainians just standing up, starting to fight, accepting the risk of what it means against one imperial power that believes that you are theirs, which means possible total annihilation. Like if you look at the cities like Mariupol or Bakhmut, the future of Ukrainians is very clear for if you let Russians come. I mean, you will see Kyiv to the ground, you will see everything to the ground, like literally, and mass graves everywhere. So, in this sense, it is like a sign of, okay, it's possible to say no. Most likely, many people will get killed if you say no. But it is a sign that is looked also on in other countries, or also inside Russia. Is possible, this possibility to say no. And this in itself is like a process of like decolonization, in the sense you revendicate your existence.
Yeah.
You refuse to shut up and to just die in an organized manner. So you become a political entity. This is what's happening here. And in this sense, it is very strictly like anti-colonial and like anti-imperial, in the sense that for sure there is the hopes that this, what is the state of Russia today, would crumble completely. And this is, I mean, here, First and practically, we need to think about what's happening here. So for Ukrainians in Ukraine, the goal to get back to the 91 borders is just because there used to be an international agreement at this moment, so it's arguable internationally, but it doesn't have any other really importance because it was already completely burned, those papers, by Russia. So even if you get there, how do you get to accountability of what was the Russian structures now that brought here? This will lead to another decades of work. And the decolonization of everybody, like, I mean, in Russia, in the schools, people are taught another history of what is really happening today. Kids are taught another. So, I mean, it's a huge work that is going to last for very long. And for sure, if possibly here can be what would be seen as a victory, which goes to a territory where then we can organize in the way without having bombs and being killed all the time, then this could lead to other struggles. And it is already now we see like this thing going a little bit everywhere in the world. You can start to see in Azerbaijan, you see very big changes of things that hasn't since 30 years, like were in a certain way. We don't know yet how it will come. Sure, there is hopes also from many people inside Russia that this would end, but there is still a huge majority of or apolitical, scared, or just don't care. So it's not really realistic for now, because also like the being in the center of the colonial imperial system makes you having at least a little bit of interest in it. But losing even this little bit for some people in Russia, it's very hard to question. And this will also come just for what I would call like material conditions, meaning not having the choice to leave your interests. But all this is going to be a long, like, anti-colonial and post-colonial, like, process in the region of the post-Soviet countries.
Yeah, it's I guess in the West it would be like creating a decolonizing the conversation, you know, of Ukraine, and what that means, and that kind of goes to something, you know, that we've talked about. The idea of media, and you talked about propaganda and how that can be used, you know, obviously for Russia's self-interest, but also for electoralism in other nations too. But I think something else that's interesting is, and you had said this earlier, the idea of all this noise and propaganda and information keeping people inactive, you know? To where people can associate these abstract ideas to images that they see, and they can write about it and talk about it, but how it really isn't representative of the real world, right, outside or away from their screen or their book or whatever they're looking at, how it excludes them from participating, actually, and engaging in reality of what's happening, and how it's almost in a way apolitical. It creates inactivity and confusion, you know. But I don't know. Could you kind of speak to your ideas on that too? Of these other, you know, reasons for why we're seeing so much of this on the internet and in media, etc.
Yeah, I think it's exactly like that. I mean, this is how the propaganda has been built inside Russia, and to have this kind of agreement that okay, anything that this government or like Putin is doing is okay. You can, it's sure the goal to put it everywhere on all political spectrum is also to destabilize if it's outside Russia. Like in Ukraine, like the aim was this, like to destabilize, to shift people into very opposing camps, so that then maybe you arrive, and it's very easy to arrive because they are already fighting each other. And this is also one goal. So for me, it's to lead you to all passivity, meaning you are not active, and but you talk, on this pacifist. But then for some, it's also like a really, you could compare with, what's happening with Trump, for example, that you could hear about freedom of expression, which would mean talking all the conspiracy theories that you hear would be okay, or to say, Nazi shit or racist shit would be okay. And this is where, at least, because the goal of this kind of freedom of expression is like the basically building up of conflict inside. So sure, there is this thing of for some that it would be just about the passiveness and this, but this I would guess is mostly linked to practical possibility of people to act, also in USA, and this no knowing what to do, and also because practically just by paying taxes you are also helping for this. So all these have to be seen exactly of what people exactly do. One of the goals is passivity when you are under its power influence, because then, for example, in Russia, it's more practical to have people who can do some critical, you can access internet and this, but you cannot organize about it. You can just have it silenced in your home, because then it doesn't matter. But then when it's outside, I would guess in Europe, at least, in USA, with Trump, for me, there's something quite obvious, but also I don't completely understand, I have to say, what's going on. But in Europe, we've seen money going for 15 years, into all the populist right-wing movements, the Le Pen family, in France, or you have the in Germany, in Italy.
AFD.
You can see this being built bit by bit, and to try to play on conflicts that can be inside the countries, to play on the racism also of Europeans, to make it come out more, so that it creates more conflict. And this at this time now, after all. What you can see that is very useful in time of the war that then Russia started to launch, because it creates doubts also on very more parliamentary level politics, and this it was quite well prepared, I would say. There was a doubt when there was the French election last year, a little bit after what if now in France would be now this extreme right wing politics going on as president. This means the one country in Europe that have the nuclear power being now in the hands of the right wing that has money from Russia from 10 years. In this situation, could have been something very critical. Can be in few years. Very radical shift, very fast of all the politics in Europe. Yeah. I don't know those kind of things. So it's for sure. One goal is for you to be passive, in the sense that passive you are more useful than active, at least if you are active against. But if you can be active for, which is claiming on making more conflict in your own place where you live between the different political spectrum, it's even more useful for the Russian propaganda. But the first level would be try to at least not have an opposition to what Russia is doing by the propaganda. Yeah, many different levels.
And so this is interesting. So this is an antidote, but it's an anecdote that I think applies, and I'll transition to the next question, which is one of the last ones. But I was talking to someone just the other day, and they were basically saying that the West, the U.S., should not be funding, giving money to Ukraine, and it was a lot of the typical Russian propaganda for justification. However, when I showed them your website, and I said, "Well, look, if your problem is you think that the government of Ukraine is all of, is this and that," which is fine. Every government can be critiqued, and including Ukraine's, and it should be. How about looking at this? Would you donate to this, or participate in mutual aid to a group like Solidarity Collectives? And the person looked at it and they said, "Yes, this I can support, actually." And I think it builds somewhat of a bridge, but it goes to the next question I have, and that's, regardless of some people's opinions, and we can't change their minds, I think that many people, hopefully most people, would look at what you're doing and agree that's a good thing. So short of people traveling, like we talked about Cooper Andrews and people who are engaging militarily, short of that, what are other ways that people can do to help Solidarity Collectives? For instance, on your website, there are some things you could assist with financially, like technical equipment, medicine, clothing, ballistic protective gears, or if people can't afford these items, you talked about Telegram and listening to people in the region and promoting those voices and understanding where, your information is coming from. So, regarding financial or otherwise, how could people say, "Yeah, I want to help out Solidarity Collectives"?
On this, I guess I could start with this also, that what you said about like the critique of government and this, because I mean there is a pretty vivid culture of criticism in Ukraine about governments, going until the point of overthrowing presidents in 2014, for example.
Good point.
And sure, I mean, everybody understands what is the state, what is the corruption, what is this and that. I mean, there is a pretty vivid culture of this, and also understanding of the limit of your own powers and what you can do and how to organize otherwise. And this, all this, for sure, for people who have the opportunity to be able to travel, stay a bit and understand, and then come back to share what they saw. I think it's, as every opportunity for people to travel is very important, because you would see and understand it more and feel it, but it's not possible for everybody. As you mentioned, for what it is for maybe some people who want to participate here in the fight, in general, it's like already combat experience is what is needed, and also because, I mean, for many different reasons, but I mean, otherwise it doesn't really make sense. Then, if it's to come, and so like me, I would suggest to stay a bit. But now, I mean, even just to come and stay, try to help in like civilian structures, and see like this is possible. But it's also possible by staying for a while, because it's not so easy to come for a little time and find exactly what to do, because things change very fast. It's not so easy to say like for 2 weeks you will have exactly something to do, but or to prepare something in advance, like to gather some people who want to prepare one project, get in contact and try to build it. Like let's take 6 months to organize something that would make sense in 6 months. What is the economy of it? How it's possible to do it? Where? Those kind of things would be super to have communication about. If we talk about our work as like as a collective, sure, the most thing that we need at the moment is very strictly money, because basically I can say that we try to help. If we share all the budget that we have, it's about €100 per person per month. At the moment, but we would need a lot more, because we don't give it like this, like €100, but we have to prioritize on what we can buy, because we cannot buy everything every month that we are asked. We would need like nearly the double of what we try to use now. So I'm sure organizing events, movie events, we have a YouTube channel where you have interviews with some of the people who are fighting, some of our comrades, and to just do a movie event for fundraising and send the money is like, and get in touch about it is great. I mean, with this we can speak. Like, we can also we are very happy to participate in events and to try to speak, answer questions if people have in direct. Like, we can do it online. So yeah, also because from USA, the to buy things directly and send them is mostly possible if someone comes, just because of border crossing of postal. Like, sending things is not so easy to send until Europe or to send until Ukraine, so it would mean to bring. But there have been some things, like specific things, like some night vision devices, some things that you can get more easily in Europe, in USA and in Europe, and that sometimes we cannot find. So for all this, there is on the website a kind of non-exhaustive list, but mainly at the end, what is important is like, get in touch, just send us a mail. The mail is on the website, solidaritycollectives.org, and there you can find, just to ask directly what we need, and then we can try to say, because every month it can change. We make fundraising campaigns to buy more expensive stuff, like now recently we could buy a car. That arrived in Kyiv. Those kind of things on the economical level. If it's on the also the local political level, which of course we can do our part, like being invited and talk with people, try to explain also our point of view on this. We can see the importance of it, and we are very happy to do it. Also, many things we cannot really understand the local politics, because it's not possible to follow what's happening exactly everywhere on many topics. So on this, about countering what is Russian propaganda, what it means in the place where you live, the dangers that you can see from them if you analyze them, on what it can mean on the long term. Because one thing that I want still to say about this is that it's going to last 4 years here, the war. Most likely we are still organizing here in 5 years. So we are trying to organize for the long term of what it means. In this term, what will be the civilian structures, what will be, who will have to fight in this time, everything will have the time to change. Many more people will get killed, and some people from the collective might be fighting at some point. From Solidarity Collectives. So all this will change, but we try to build structure to be able to answer this and to stay in the long term. And on this, on the long term, we to try to like do this for me basic anti-fascist work also in USA, about who is saying this kind of propaganda and why. And what is the goal in this? Because if it's to lead to don't support Ukraine, and yes, it's expensive and this, but maybe then like vote for someone like Trump, I'm sorry, but you have a problem. Even if it's like me, I wouldn't be on the side of like the voting out of my personal like political like strategies, but on the very practical level, what it means on the violence of it, also on the erasement of all that could be post-colonial studies and activity in USA, not only about here, but all this can lead you and to in USA to have more conflict, and this will be pushed by the Russian propaganda. So the more you share it about Ukraine mechanically, the more you are sharing it to have more trouble also inside USA with all that is leftist or anarchist politics in USA in general, because those are connected. If you look at who is saying, maybe not in the left, but at least in the in some part of the writing, and to look what is like the different spectrums and what kind of choices they make regarding Ukraine and where it can lead to your own like political struggles also in USA. For me, this kind of work would be something very important to do, to have an understanding, and so for us, like to have more understanding of what this means, because on the long term, I mean, I could imagine that at some point maybe the West like cannot continue because this kind of propaganda and tiredness and this and like could actually work on the long term, because now I don't really see it right now. I still see a very big consensus about helping Ukrainians, I think, at least on the like state levels. But it might be in the future, and if it stopped, I mean, Ukrainians don't have the choice to stop. So sometimes when we hear, we are tired of this war, you know, like we joke like, yeah, sure, I mean, we are also and come here to help us stop it, like basically, because this is what's going on. Like if we're not gonna stop, and what it means without support, okay, I don't know, but it will be how it will be. And we have to start to organize for this eventuality also, which is how it will be in 5 years, how it will be in 10 years. Very hard to do, but still needed, and very needed from our side. So this I would say like also to politicize and to try to analyze like the relations between the propaganda and what's going on with Russia, with your own local politics, and why, and where they are. Yeah, this I would say is ways to support practically.
All right, Anton. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I like to the people listening who have been doing it. And also, like for those who maybe will ago already, we can say a big thank you for the solidarity that we've been seeing for like a year and a half. It's been huge if we count our political movement's capacities. And so yeah, just a thank you would be my end word, and hopefully find you in our struggle in the next times.
All right, Anton, thank you for meeting with me. Be well, be safe.
Thank you too, yeah. Be safe too.